Today, more from the property market frontline. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. It's Worth My Latest Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Chris Bates. Hello, Chris.
G'day, Martin. Good to see you again.
Yeah, I know. New year and same old in some regards, but also a whole bunch of new things to talk about. And of course, as you know, a financial advisor and as a mortgage broker, you're right there in the middle of it all, aren't you?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, different year, same feeling, I think. And if anything, it's you can feel the FOMO or that kind of sneaking back into the market. I mean, sentiments obviously shifted dramatically, and we know that investments, a lot of it prices are driven by sentiment. So the whole media is behind it, that whole, you know, you could almost copy and paste articles. I mean, I just saw one literally 20 minutes ago, you know, worked at McDonald's, I've got 20 properties, and it's front page on, you know, news.com.au. So it's all back, it's all changed. And so, yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of buyers out there that are reading and just off they go. I think the frustrating thing a lot of your potential followers is that, you know, what they want is this, and the market's delivering something else. And so now they're probably feeling a bit disillusioned and saying, well, I thought the market was going to crash and now it hasn't. And what do I do? And that kind of reactory sort of mindset will basically encourage bad behavior. So what they'll then go and do now is they'll go and buy a poor property because they will. Well, I thought it was going to blow up. It didn't. Now I'm going to go buy. And that's another thing that I've noticed. That happened in a lot of the 16, 17. Like a lot of people just went and bought stupid because they were just like, well, I thought it was going to go down. And now I'm proved wrong. And they entered the market at the absolute wrong time.
Yeah. Well, I always say to people, it hasn't gone down so far. But just remember that there are some fundamentals, you know, like debt to income ratio, GDP, you know, there's a few fundamentals that tell us we're still in a very stretched environment. And there is no logic that says it's going to continue to go higher and higher and higher forever. So people need to be very careful. In fact, they need to be more careful at this point than 6 months or 12 months ago.
100%. Like the new off the plan space, like as soon as there's more demand, they're building. So like as soon as we can sell more apartments. And so that's going to put a cap on prices, and no one wants the old stuff. The new house and land packages, as soon as there's more demand, they're building. Like, so, you know, that's putting a cap on prices, plus low wage growth out there. So it's only like a fraction of the, it's like of the ASX 200. It's like 10 companies are going up, right? 990 companies are just going sideways. Some are still going backwards. And so I think the problem is the media reports on that 10. And then overinflated anyway.
That's what we're trying to do on the channel here, find a slightly more balanced view so that people get a sense of there's some good news, but there's also some careful news and some concerning news. So, you know, nothing's ever straightforward. And it's interesting, of course, because there is a very strong sense from both the Reserve Bank and from Treasury that the property market, you know, rising prices stimulates wealth. We need wealth because effectively that's going to stimulate spending, and we need spending to stimulate the economy. That's sort of the argument on one hand. Although, of course, Phil Lowe this last week also said he's worried about the fact that house prices are taking off, and he's worried about the amount of debt in the system. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, Phil, you created the problem in the first place. So interesting tension between those two positions.
Yeah, I mean, his role is to get full employment, get inflation, and they never want to admit that what, you know, by reducing rates, they're causing asset price inflation. And, you know, all the facts are out there that that's what it does. And so what he's you know, cut rates three times, knows that potentially there's a couple more in it, but he's already saying, look, I don't really want to because I know the impact this is having on the property market. I mean, even interesting last week, he also said that he thinks rates are going to stay low for potentially decades, or it's quite likely that we could see that. And when you price property on a, you know, a 2% interest rate for 20, 30 years, that's pretty scary because, you know, unfortunately people will start to change behavior. And that's what's kind of happening. You know, people are starting to get comfortable with rates at 3%. You know, and that wasn't long ago till we were talking fours, fives, even sixes, sevens, you know, in the past. So if we start getting everyone really comfortable at 3% and they're not going to rise, unfortunately, that'll push a lot of people into the market.
So, yeah, we had the tax cuts, you know, and not all that, but a lot of that got pushed through. We've also got very cheap rates for new deals. And that's the thing that I'm quite amazed about. If you look at what the, you know, first-time buyer could get or somebody refinance can get, the rates are remarkably low, aren't they?
Yep, so most rates are under 3 now. Like, I mean, you have to fight for it, but you'll get, you know, something high 2s. And then the investor rate, that's the interesting thing. I mean, the margin now is so slim. And comparing it, it was nothing, and then it went to, you know, over 1%, and now it's back down to, like, you know, maybe 20, 30 basis points. Not much at all. So the investors are definitely starting to see, you know, when they look at the numbers and things like that, we're starting to run cash flows, and it's, a lot more investors are back. I mean, the tax cuts, the bushfires and things that happen there, you know, is the budget surplus going to happen? You know, the coronavirus, et cetera. Do they bring forward tax cuts? You know, so there's lots happening in 2020, but obviously rates are extremely low.
Yeah. And are you seeing much differentiation between different areas? I'm thinking of, you know, close into town versus further out and houses versus units, or is it pretty much across the board that you're seeing the momentum picking up?
I mean, the housing market, things that suit families, you know, that's that real emotional pull. Yep, definitely. I mean, that's starting to spread, like the ripple effect. If these suburbs get too expensive, people, you know, start going where someone's going to offer similar lifestyle benefits but is close by, and so you end up getting people pushing out. I mean, I saw some massive results in just two-bedroom units in the city, you know, in the middle ring. I mean, no one wants to buy the new property now. It's been in the papers long enough, over 12 months now. So everyone's switching off to that, and then they go by the first home buyers, investors. This 5% deposit scheme, I actually, you know, didn't think it would have a very big impact on the market. But, you know, just the type of people that have been coming to us and have read about it and are wanting to enter the market, it's pretty astounding. And those places in January and February, they went in days. They didn't, you know, just drag out for the whole month. But, you know, they're going off. And so a lot of the people I've spoken to, somehow they don't qualify. Maybe they're earning a bit too much. They didn't realize it. Maybe they've got a bit too much savings, or what they want to buy is too expensive. So, but they're still like, well, let's enter the market anyway. Let's get some money from parents, or let's see if I can save some more money, etc. So it's just created that sense of more demand.
Yeah, and the results came out today, didn't it? And they basically said there's quite a lot of demand for that 5% government-backed scheme out in the regions, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... you know, you go back to what George Bush did in 2003, you know, like every great American dream, everyone should own a home, and it's got that same sense to it. And it's and what it all is doing is bringing forward future demand. But unfortunately, that's the only ticket that the Australian government's got, is to create high house price inflation. And, you know, it's actually working. So it's just because that creates a transaction. If that one buys it off an investor, or they buy it off a, you know, a young couple, then they can take those profits. And generally speaking, mental accounting is they take those profits, go back to the bank, and then create more money in the system. So it's just creating that kind of that multiplier effect.
Yep. And but bearing in mind it's the only growth game in town, it's not perhaps too surprising. And I guess the construction sector is quite interesting, right? We saw that very much sort of going backwards for quite some time. Approvals seem to be just a little stronger. But we've also got still an overhang of existing new construction still being discounted quite heavily.
So just in the last couple of weeks, I've really started to see, you know, some development sites go, and it's starting to get advertised more out there that construction, the developers are basically starting to buy again. But this takes years. So there's going to be this, you know, a lot of stock hitting the market. There's so many apartment buildings that aren't built yet. That's going to flood the market for renters and things like that. But, you know, I do think the developers are back building again. And so maybe this big, and because of house prices going up and, you know, I guess their options becoming limited, then they push, and then they go and buy off the plan again. And you know that they just basically short-term memory bias. We forget about all those Opal Tower issues, and we just start buying again. And so, unfortunately, we don't remember the risks.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The surveys that I continue to run still have a significant concern about the construction questions, particularly off the plan construction. But as you say, they're compromising those because they want to get in.
I think she'll be right. Mentality is they go into the suite, they don't want to do it. I mean, I've got a client literally right now, and I'm trying to convince her not to buy a newish three-bedroom apartment in the eastern suburbs. The reason why she's buying that is because, you know, she's looked in the houses and the semis and things like that, and, you know, she just gets gravitated towards this new shiny apartment. And, you know, when you look at the price, it's a bit cheaper and you're not getting the same thing. And so, unfortunately, people just get wrapped up when they go into these buildings, and they just think she'll be right. This is an anomaly, you know. My building's fine. I've seen it so many times, and the reality is they just disconnect from the wider picture.
Yeah, interesting. Now, I've got a question for you, Chris. In this sort of more ebullient market, how do you figure out what fair value is? What tools do you use, and, you know, what calculations do you go through to try and figure out what the value should be?
So you first need to really understand whether your property is a quality investment or not. Because that factors into a lot to what it's actually worth. So, you know, if it's a south-facing block on a busy road, it's been on the market for, you know, 2 years, which a client recently, there was a property on the market they were looking at and they didn't realise it'd been on the market for 2 years. If it's a quality investment, then you should probably move to the next stage and then try to consider its value. And, I mean, really, I would not use any of the automated valuation models. You know, even this morning, a client, you know, the valuation model says 900. I mean, we got a valuation at 1.1. Like, it's just, you know, because they didn't know it was renovated. They didn't know, you know, real scarcity of it. So I wouldn't use any of the automated valuation models. I do think you need to be in the market. And I do think you need to have looked for 3 to 6 months. This is a big problem where someone's living in, you know, some area and they're thinking about buying on the other side of town. And they're, you know, taking their eastern suburbs hat and they're trying to buy in the North Shore. So you need that kind of 3-6 months. You need to have gone through properties. And so you've like literally have seen, you know, maybe 10, 20 properties in that area as reference points. You can't just look online at Domain and Real Estate. You've actually got to go through the properties, because then you can really understand what's actually good value, what's not. And then when you get to that point, then you can start comparing land size. You know, that one sold for. But the problem is, if you've got a terrace and you're trying to buy in, say, Annandale or the Inner West, it's pretty easy to compare like for like because they're the same sort of property. But as soon as you start going to the middle and outer ring, let's say, or where properties are quite diverse, you've really got to be careful what comparables you use. Because a big flat block's not going to be the same as a steep block, you know. Something on the, you know, the premium streets on the north side is not the same as more of the cut-through roads, you know. And so you really need that insider knowledge. And, you know, once you factor all this in, then you can start to get a price. So I think people want an easy solution, but it's actually a lot of legwork and knowing the market.
Right. And so the implication of that is the publicly available information on places like Domain or even CoreLogic, that could actually be a distraction, really, from getting to the true value.
Yeah, it's literally going around the suburb and really knowing and then back testing it and saying, well, yeah, the growth in this area has been 20%. Well, like, you know, and you know, doing, you literally have to go through a bit of a process to, I think I've seen buyer's agents buy, I've seen, you know, and just really quickly basing it off a couple of sales in the area. And it's very dangerous because, you know, you don't actually know what the situation was behind selling that property. So it could be that it was a really motivated vendor that just had to sell fast because they wanted to buy another property. And so if you think that was fair value, well, it probably wasn't because it was sold under a distressed state. The other way is, you know, a client literally sold a property last week. They were accepting an offer at 2.3. Deal was getting done. They'd done a ring around to you know, the other people who've got contracts, and all of a sudden a lady jumps in at 2375, which was quite a lot above market value. I mean, he was already happy with 2.3. So it was just a desperate, you know, buyer. And so if you think that was fair value, well, it wasn't. So you just got to really understand the story behind each sale, and you won't know that unless you know all the agents.
Right. And that's where those relationships are pretty important, I guess, as you're trying to navigate your way around. And, I, you know, that's interesting because, of course, I've spoken to some people who say, oh, you know, the future of real estate's all going to be, you know, these online tools and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they're missing such a critical part of the equation, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, if you're selling a bog standard apartment and it's in an area where there's thousands of other bog standard apartments and you just would never buy those, but those type of properties, it's extremely hard to sell them. And, you know, maybe a platform will probably help them, you know, maybe turn over quicker. But, you know, those are the properties that need an agent more than anything, because they need an agent with a bit of creativity to explain to buyers that this is actually a scarce asset. It's, you know, one of a kind. The reality is there's, you know, thousands of them. So I don't see that, you know, that digital kind of real estate agent really ever coming in. They might systemize the process and make it, you know, much more friendlier, but you still need the whole system's built on kind of like a smokes and mirrors and trying to create that one buyer and competition. And unfortunately, the last thing you want as a seller is just to that buyer to know they're their only buyer. You need that competition. So as a buyer, you want it, but as a seller, you don't.
Very asymmetric then, isn't it? Now, the interesting then to think about, you know, we've talked about some of the positives, but there are a few clouds on the horizon, which is probably just worth reflecting on, right? And one place to perhaps start would be the asset case and, you know, even open banking, you know, some changes to regulation that may have a little bit of an impact ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, APRA, you know, don't know what they were thinking, changing the assessment rate. Let the tax cuts just go through. Let something happen. Don't just rapid fire. You know, APRA to go back on that and to change the rules around the assessment rate. You know, it's a big call to go back into the, you know, they don't really want to be seen as they're controlling the property market. So that was crazy, but it's happened now. So that's increased borrowing capacities. HEMs have gone up. But this whole living expenses thing, you know, unfortunately, I wish that Westpac actually lost that, and I wish that ASIC won and, you know, changes went through on actual living expenses, and, you know, we could actually create a fairer system long term. And unfortunately, it hasn't happened like that, and the banks are back lending and not really looking at expenses, you know, anywhere. So unless something dramatically changes there, I just don't think ASIC are a bit of a toothless tiger, and the banks are just going to continue doing it now because they feel like that case has kind of let them off. So the open banking thing is very interesting. Macquarie are already not asking for bank statements of other banks. And so they've already got the data there. Now, if we fast forward 12 months and it's all out there, you know, how do you get around this living expenses issue? And that's where I think, you know, borrowers will start getting creative again and all sorts of things will happen. But you're right, this thing hasn't been solved, and it will need to be solved, because if people start borrowing on, you know, low assessment rates and low living expenses, which aren't real, you can see where the problem's going to get, where people are just hamstring themselves with too much debt. Even with low rates, a lot of debt's still hard to, you've got to keep paying the repayment every month, even on low rates. So if you do lose your job, or you do get made, you know, want to swap jobs or something like that, you know, you get stuck.
Yeah, and the average new loan is, you know, up 5% from where it was just 6 months ago. So remarkably big turnaround, and that could definitely have impacts later, particularly in some of the major markets where people are having to spend more just to get in the market.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So there's always the marginal buyer that's willing to go out there and, you know, based on lower assessment rates and based on what they need to spend and what they're willing to sacrifice, you know, they're willing to spend more. And, you know, there's this once, you know, people, you know, there's this kind of physical sort of emotional need that they've got, and, you know, whether that's families or kids or work, etc., that's driving them. And then you've got this kind of social pressure where everyone else is doing it. And then you've got price rises, which is proving to the people who have done it, it's a good decision. And so then they're going to enter and borrow more money. So it doesn't surprise me at all that the loans have jumped up dramatically. I mean, and that will flow straight through to prices because that's all new money. And then you've got not only average loan, it's actually how much does that total loan amount? That's the interesting number. The average number is great, but how much is the total lending? And settlement numbers for brokers have, not just brokers, but brokers are a good sign, are up dramatically in the last 6 to 12 months. And so the volume's going up and the average. So that's a double sort of lift.
Well, there's actually something quite interesting happening, and that is that we've still got a lot of people repaying mortgages and paying down debt. But we've also got more people coming into the market with bigger debt. So in fact, there's a tilting going on, right? So effectively, the risks in the mortgage portfolio are actually rising quite fast, simply because the average new loan is a lot bigger than the one that's being paid down.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the problem I've got with all of that is it's fine. You might be able to manage it today, but what happens if, you know, there's a change of circumstance, or if the coronavirus has a significant impact on the local economy and the global economy, and, you know, things can change. And I just wonder whether people have really thought through what they're getting themselves into, because, again, they're being caught up in this must buy, must buy, must buy.
Yeah, I think that, you know, most people aren't switched on, Martin. They're not really thinking that much detail, to be honest. They're not really, they've got a wife, a kids, husband, that they, you know, they want a house. They've got family that have all, you know, pushing them. And unfortunately, they kind of feel like that's the, they're willing to sacrifice for it. You know, and I guess they always think that, you know, it won't happen to them. It's like insurance. Why have we got a massive under insurance problem? Well, no one thinks they're going to get sick, but the reality is people do. And so, you know, the problem is one person here and there doesn't really matter. It's when, you know, the whole market gets hit with a big unemployment, and that's when you see lots of supply hit. But that, unfortunately, is not what happened in 2019. You know, a lot of supply hit in the off-the-plan sector, you know, rural areas and et cetera, but they didn't really hit. There's just everyone's battened down the hatches and very few had to sell. And so, you know, I agree with you that, you know, that's the problem, that going into too much debt. It's just the problem is when it's, you know, if it's a case by case, someone here losing their job, it's all right. But it's when that contagion effect happens.
Oh, it's structural, of course, it's the issue. And I'm interested also about the, you know, number of listings versus numbers of sales, because it looks to me as though the number of listings are rising a little, but then the number of people who want to buy is also rising. So there's still a bit of a Mexican standoff, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's shifting now. So I think, you know, it takes time to sell your property, and you have to have the confidence to find another property that you're going to move into. I mean, literally just jumped off the call with a client, you know, selling an apartment in, you know, Bellevue Hill, wanting to move to the Northern Beaches. The problem was not so much getting a good price for his apartment. It was more, can he find something that he really wants? And there was just no good properties were ready to sell last year because, you know, there was just, it takes 3 months to get, pick your agent, tidy it up, style it, you know, and then you've got to time your campaign for school holidays. And so a lot of people just said, well, actually, I'll list it in February. And so what you're seeing is you're actually seeing a lot more quality properties on the market now. And then that's now encouraging, for example, this client to say, actually, I'd really like that property. Or I really want to do that. Now's the right time, et cetera. So I do think we're going to start to see quite a lot of rises in listings because people are seeing other properties. And then you start to, which is exactly what the state government wants, which is what, you know, keeps the market going even faster.
Yeah, very interesting. And what are downsizers doing? Because it looks to me as though more of them are now looking to sell. You know, prices are rising and they want perhaps to release some of that equity. And how's that playing into the market?
It's true. I mean, a lot of downsizers probably got a lot of very scared in the last couple of years because, you know, a lot of their wealth is tied up in the family home. And if that was selling 15, 20, 25% under what it was selling in 2016 when they were thinking about retiring, or, you know, and they could get through that, then if they could get what they could get in 2016-17, they're going to list. The problem is a lot of them are then thinking, well, why don't we just hold on for a couple more years? You know, if there's steam behind the market, Why don't we just rent it out for a couple of years, rent somewhere else? Why don't we? And when they look to downsize, there's not many options really, because they don't really want that new apartment that's a one or a two bedder where there's lots of other ones. They want that kind of bigger three bed, let's say, so the grandkids and things like that. But they want to stay in the area that they live. And so in these kind of, let's say these premium areas where they've got an expensive house, unless they can move into an apartment, there's not many of them available. There's not many new ones coming. They're very expensive. The transactions isn't actually there, the cost. So they're going, well, do I leave this big house to move into a really big apartment for the same price? And then it's a case of maybe, so I just don't think that downsize of things happening on the scale that people think it's going to happen, because where they want to live is there's just not building many apartments.
Yeah, well, we're seeing that. We see a lot of people saying, I want to move, but then they say, but I can't find anybody. I want to move too. So what do? You just stay where you are. And I guess the other question that's coming back on now is rent vesting, right? We're seeing that now very much back in vogue, aren't we?
Yeah, it's interesting. So interest-only loans are kind of, bit by bit, like they were off the table there for a bit, and now they're kind of, there's no real concern around, getting them anymore. And that's what drives a rent vesting strategy. If you have to pay down a big portfolio of properties, then it really struggles. So you will see that the more people who can't afford to buy, they will start to go down this rent vesting strategy. Unfortunately, I've seen it not work that many times because, what ends up happening, the reality is, it was 730 report last week was talking about this. The guy there was, they went down this rent vesting strategy, reinvested the money, but that need for home ownership really and the problems with renting meant that they're now changing plans and going back into the market. And so the rent vesting strategy, and generally now you can't borrow a lot more for investors versus home buyers, and your home grows tax-free. So I just don't think it's like that, build that massive portfolio and then sell it all down and buy a home really works. But you're right, it's coming back.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that in some of the surveys, but I've also noticed that there are more investors who are still not really seeing a huge amount of return from their investment. The rental growth is not there. A little bit of capital growth now, but of course they took a bath when rates dropped. So in fact, they're not really ahead. And so from a cash flow perspective, once you take account of the transactions of buying into the market initially and, a full view of what it's really costing, they're still not making a particularly good return.
We speak to people every day, around their portfolios. And even last week, Friday, it's Monday now. She had two properties. She couldn't get into the Sydney market. She somehow went to a financial advisor who referred her to a property spruiker, and she bought two places in southeast Queensland. And one's gone backwards. It was an apartment. The townhouse she got, well, no, that was the townhouse. The house she bought's gone up like 5% in 8 years or something. So most people haven't done a great job with investing. It's usually, the ones that have bought really scarce assets that really suit the family market, but they're usually more expensive. And so investors can't afford them and don't want to take that much risk, I guess. And so most investment portfolios, we spoke to a guy last week, he's got seven properties. One of those has done really well. And so the other six haven't. So you're right. It's it's not just this easy thing. You just go and buy a property, and it goes up. A lot of them just go sideways.
And maintenance costs. People keep forgetting maintenance costs, right? The ongoing maintenance of that property, right? Because every property costs, isn't it?
And tradies make quite a lot of. Not saying it's a lot of money, or they don't deserve it, or anything like that. But you wouldn't want to be, spending. $20,000 on a kitchen worth $150,000, yep. That kitchen maybe is a little bit cheaper somewhere else, a bit more expensive in the city or something like that, but it's not much. And so you're right. You've got to be careful around, maintenance costs. And that's generally why better property, more expensive assets sometimes, especially if you've done your building in Perth and you really know what you're buying is a quality building, it's less risk than kind of going and buying three cheaper properties that are, cheaper.
Yeah, very good advice there. My last question then, Chris, relates to this question of people looking beyond, say, Sydney and Melbourne, right, where prices are so high. It's quite risky, though, isn't it, to go and look in an area that you don't know?
Yeah, it is. That, you know, there's a number of ways you can kind of lower that risk. Is, you know, Airbnbs, you know, staying there, renting there for a month. Don't have to rent there for 6 months, like, but, you know, just get there and do the commute. And but yeah, you know, it's, the risk is you get there and then you buy and then you have to do a U-turn. And, you know, I've seen that. Clients have bought it maybe a bit too far away from the city, and then they've got there and they wish they bought a bit closer, and then their situation's changed and they've bought a bit closer, and that place has gone up more than the place they bought. And so it's been a huge opportunity cost, and, you know, they can't afford to keep it as an investment. So you're right. I think there's, unfortunately, though, it's going to be the reality. The housing unaffordability problem in 2016-17, it was all the front page of everything, and that's what was driving Labor's housing policy. That's all back. You know, it might not be on the front pages today, but it's happening out there. And as soon as this frustration starts to build over the next 12 months, you will start people getting really tense with Sydney and Melbourne, you know, not as much, but Sydney more so. And then they'll start considering leaving Sydney, or do we, you know, go to Brisbane, or do we go to Melbourne, or, you know, do we move up to the Central Coast or Wollongong or Newcastle? And so there is going to be this, you know, people, a lot of people pushed out, basically.
Yeah. Well, once again, we see, you know, a few months down the track and things are just morphing and changing. But what would be the one piece of advice that you give anybody thinking about property just at the moment?
It's really thinking through, like, how, like, your stepping stones. If you're buying this property, you've got to really make sure it fits into your life and you can grow into it. And it's a really good investment. It's just last, you know, a couple of weeks ago on the phone, and a client was like, "Well, it doesn't really matter. It's a home. It doesn't matter if it's a good investment, and I'm never going to sell it." And I'm like, "Well, you know, he's early 30s, and, you know, at some point you are going to sell it. You know." Yes, you think you're going to stay there forever, but that's just not true. There's no stats to say you're going to live there for 60 years. But even still, you're going to die in your 90s. You're going to pass it on to someone. It's so important that it's a good investment. It's not just a home. And you need to make sure it's something you can grow into, because if you don't think about that now and then you run out of space and you wish you had more and you have a family and things like that, then you've got transaction costs, then you've got to move again, and you know, that whole feeling of not getting content in your home, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of home ownership if you don't feel happy in the home and you're just bored. So it's really thinking through your long-term life. And if you are going to buy an investment property, go for a quality over quantity strategy. So just get one or just get two. Don't go for 10 or 20 or think, oh, I need a property every year or that nonsense. You know, less is more.
Chris, that's great advice. And thank you once again for your time and, you know, for your wisdom there. I think that's very, very important at this interesting time. And we'll catch up again down the road and see where this winding road takes us.
That's it. Thanks, Martin. I really appreciate the chat. Cheers.
Take care. So there you have it. I think some very important words of wisdom from Chris once again. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance and Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.